You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Midwest's largest Viking festival is coming to Green Bay this weekend. We'll talk to one of the organizers about Scandinavian culture here in Wisconsin. Now it's election season in the state and around the U.S., and according to a new report on congressional and state district boundaries, quote, America's approach to districting is both unique and, by the standards of modern democracy, uniquely awful. Why? Two things. One of them is gerrymandering, according to the report. The other, a fundamental decision in how we represent ourselves in legislatures. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how we got to where we are today with state and federal legislative maps? How worried are you about partisan gerrymandering around the country, here in Wisconsin in particular? Are there changes you'd like to see? Do you want to see Wisconsin, for example, go to some kind of independent commission to draw those lines in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow in the political reform program at New America. He's author of Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America, lecturer at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Advanced Governmental Studies, and co-host of the podcast Politics in Question. His recent report for New America is called What We Know About Redistricting and Redistricting Reform. Lee, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it is a great delight to be talking about this crucial topic with you at this crucial time in our nation's history.
There's a two-part problem as I read the report. Let's start with the one you spend the most time on and the one that I think is most familiar for people, gerrymandering, the idea of partisan line drawing for our congressional seats. In your report, you say it's got a long history in America, but in some ways it's particularly bad now. Why is that?
Well, it is particularly bad now because the stakes of our elections are so high and our parties are so evenly balanced that if one party gets a hold on the state legislature and uses that hold to give itself a few extra congressional seats or a few extra seats in the state legislature, it gets a boost that allows it to get 100% of the power in the Congress or in the state legislature with a very narrow majority. And you know, when we have this moment of close elections and extreme hyper-partisanship, every little advantage is just incredibly important and incredibly consequential.
The other part of this report that I think people might take for granted is the way we elect people to Congress or the legislature, single representative districts, where this chunk of real estate elects one member of Congress, that chunk over there does another one. This is just how we've all voted probably for our entire lives if we lived in the U.S. Why do you see that as a fundamental problem?
Well, the problem is that it's the single member district that makes gerrymandering possible. Matt, imagine if there was one statewide district in Wisconsin and all representatives were elected proportionally from that statewide district. Would you be able to gerrymander it? Nope. So really, you can only do gerrymandering with single member districts because this gives you many different options of ways that you can draw district lines and push the other party's voters into just a few districts and spread your voters more equally across all districts. But take that possibility away and you don't have gerrymandering anymore. Now, the U.S. is just one of really a handful of advanced democracies that still uses what I would consider to be a very antiquated system of single member districts. It doesn't make any sense. The second district of Wisconsin is not an organic community. It's an artificially drawn community. I think, unless maybe I don't know something about the second district of Wisconsin that you know.
Right. And that takes us back to gerrymandering and how those lines with single member districts are drawn. Can you talk about some of the tactics you looked at in the report that, say, a state legislature might use to pack, say, a lot of Democratic voters into a second district or Republican voters in another state into another district?
Well, the basic game with gerrymandering and districting more broadly is that it matters very much where voters live. So ideally you'd pack all of your opposing party's votes into just a few districts and spread, or basically as many as you can, and then spread your voters out more equally. This is possible, again, with single member districts, but the idea is that it's not so much how many voters you have statewide, but rather what the balance is in each district. So this is the classic technique. Distribute your voters more efficiently so you win more districts, and distribute your opponents' voters less efficiently so they are all concentrated in a handful of districts. Now, the reality of our politics is that Democrats mostly live in the cities. In Wisconsin, for example, you have two cities that are predominantly Democratic, and the rest of the state not so much. This is not unique to Wisconsin, but what it means is that Republicans have a kind of natural advantage just by being the party of the countryside and smaller towns, and Democrats have a natural disadvantage by being the party of cities because they naturally concentrate more of their voters. It also means that it's not really gerrymandering that's causing the decline in congressional districts that are competitive. It's geographic sorting. If Republicans and Democrats live in very different places, it's just really hard to draw competitive districts. And I think this is really important because we often blame gerrymandering for extremism and for everything that's gone wrong with our politics. But the problem is that it's not just, although gerrymandering does make it worse, when you have single member districts in which you can only have one winner, Democrats stop competing for districts that are outside of the major cities, and Republicans stop competing for districts that are in the major cities, and you wind up with this bifurcated binary system in which the two parties just don't really compete against each other.
Talking to Lee Drutman from the group New America. He's the author of a new report called What We Know About Redistricting and Redistricting Reform. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. In just a few moments, we'll look at independent commissions in some states, whether they make a difference. What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brad is with us in Jefferson. Brad, hi.
Hi there. I think that Wisconsin is gerrymandered so badly, the Republicans don't really need to listen to the people because they don't need the people's support. They've got power, and a lot of that comes from big business money. But it ends up being that the Republicans then ignore the will of the people. You see that in this referendum that Evers is talking about right now.
Brad, thanks for that call. Lee, do you agree with Brad that the two distortions you talk about, gerrymandering and sort of the geographic way we do districts, ends up allowing a party in power to ignore the public will, as Brad worries?
Well, I think what you have in Wisconsin and some other states are, Wisconsin is a 50-50 state, but the congressional maps are drawn in a way that benefits Republicans. The legislative maps have been terribly gerrymandered. So Republicans pay attention to their voters. Democrats pay attention to their voters. Now, I think one of the challenges in this particular political moment that we're in which the parties are extremely polarized is that there is no single will of the people. There's a Democratic vision for the state and for the country. There's a Republican vision for the state or the country. And to think that, well, if only the districts were drawn more fairly, the will of the people would be represented, ignores this deep level of polarization that is a product of the urban-rural split in our politics, refracted through single member districts in the two-party system. So while gerrymandering has obviously given Republicans an advantage in the state of Wisconsin, the deeper problem is also the way in which it reinforces this polarization, which makes it hard to agree on anything So there is no real sense of what do the people want, because there's Republican people and Democratic people in our politics right now.
Brad, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lee, in your new report, you look at the states that have come up with some kind of alternative to having, you know, state legislatures draw these lines. What, if any, kind of impact did that end up having?
So there are a couple of states that have moved to independent citizen commissions, which are really, truly independent from the state legislatures. And it seems as if California, Colorado, Michigan, these are states that have done this, have produced maps that are at least fairer to both parties. So the balance of representation is roughly equal to the party's vote share across the state. However, they haven't produced that many competitive districts because of the problem that I mentioned earlier, which is that Republicans and Democrats just live in very different places, so it's very hard to draw competitive districts. So independent redistricting commissions, if they were, they are truly independent of the state legislature, and the state legislature has no power to override them, which is the case in some states that do have commissions, but truly independent commissions do produce a modest improvement in the fairness, but they still are unable to draw very many competitive districts.
We're talking to Lee Drutman, senior fellow in the political reform program at the organization New America, about his report, What We Know About Redistricting and Redistricting Reform. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a change in how Wisconsin draws its political maps for members of the U.S. House of Representatives, for members of the State Assembly and Senate? Do you think it would make a difference if we had some kind of independent system instead of having whoever's in charge of the state legislature do it, as filtered ultimately through the courts in many cases? And what about the urban-rural divide between parties? Do you think there's a way to get a more representative, whatever that might mean, outcomes in elections? What do you think of the idea of something like, hey, the whole state votes for Congress and proportional representation determines how many members from each party go to Washington? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with senior fellow Lee Drutman from the group New America, looking at his recent report on redistricting and redistricting reform. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think gerrymandering, partisan ways to draw these lines for legislatures here in Wisconsin and nationally, are a problem? If so, what would you like to see as a solution? Do you have questions for our guest about how this works around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls. Zach is with us now in Elk Mound. Zach, hi.
Hi. I do believe the gerrymandering is a problem in Wisconsin. I'm sure other places too. I'd just like to get your guests' thoughts about ranked choice voting.
Zach, thanks for the call. Yeah, some members of the legislature from both parties have floated ideas about ranked choice voting here in Wisconsin. Lee, big in the news after the special congressional election in Alaska. Do you have thoughts on ranked choice?
I have lots of thoughts on ranked choice voting. I've done actually another report, What We Know About Ranked Choice Voting. So I think ranked choice voting is an improvement over the existing system of first-past-the-post voting, but I think it's a pretty minor improvement. I think the real, it doesn't solve the gerrymandering problem, and because it doesn't address the problem of single-member districts. To me, that's the core problem, is that as long as we have single-member districts, we have the possibility of gerrymandering. And we have districts that are lopsidedly Democratic or lopsidedly Republican, so ranked choice voting won't even really matter in in those elections because it's just so solid they won party or the other. Now, I could see the case for doing statewide proportional representation with ranked choice voting, and that's a system that's used to elect the Australian Senate, for example, is to have larger multi-member districts with ranked choice voting. It's also used to elect the Parliament of Ireland. So I think there's value there. But without addressing the core problem of the single member district, ranked choice voting is not going to do all that much. I think it could work well in state, in more local elections, like city elections, which are often nonpartisan. But as far as solving the problem of gerrymandering, it's not going to solve the problem of gerrymandering.
Zach, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jimmy joins us now in Oconomowoc. Jimmy, hi.
Hi. Three words. John Wesley Powell. So John Wesley Powell is the first guy to go down the Grand Canyon. He explored and surveyed the West. And he proposed way, way back what should be our natural districting policy throughout the nation. And that, to wit, is through watersheds. Watersheds represent our primary necessity for resource management and are a natural guide to districting people together in communities that really matter to them. So that's my proposal.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Jimmy hits ultimately, Lee, I think, on one of the criteria, communities of shared interest that goes into setting district lines, at least in theory. But that's just one of, I think, five, and nobody really agrees on what all five of them mean. Can you talk about all the different things people are trying to balance?
Yeah, so the first and perhaps most central thing that people talk about is the idea of fairness to both parties, that it should be neutral, shouldn't advantage Democrats or Republicans. And given our close two-party politics, this is obviously a central focus and something that the independent commissions can do a decent job of. Then there's the ideal of having competitive districts, which, you know, we think, well, elections should be competitive, but again, given that Democrats and Republicans live in very different places, it's very hard to draw competitive districts within the single member framework. And so now we have about 10% of districts this election that are like really competitive, which is kind of an absurd definition of democracy if we have 90% of elections in which there's no real competition. So those are the big two. Then there's the question of compactness, which is that we like districts that look compact, or at least don't spread out over too big of an area. This is a little bit more of an aesthetic choice, but I think it connects to the idea of communities of interest, which is that you should keep communities together, which gets on the question of maybe watersheds are the right community of interest. And that's it's a novel idea. I admit this is the first time I've heard that. But it is certainly intriguing. And then finally, a fifth criteria is the idea of being fair to racial minorities by allowing them to elect candidates who represent them. And this is the idea of majority-minority districts. And that is also a challenge within the single-member district framework because it's not always the case that people of communities of color live in distinct areas. Sometimes they are they live more diffusely in a way that makes it harder to elect a majority-minority, or to have a majority-minority district. Nonetheless, that has been a way in which minority representation in Congress has increased over the years. It may be harder to improve on that much now. So those are the five criteria: partisan fairness, competitiveness, compactness, keeping communities of interest together, and fair racial representation.
Thanks for that call, Lee. Just, I want to take our last couple of minutes since we keep running up against the problems you see with a single member district. How do we get from that to something else?
Well, the alternative of multi-member districts with proportional representation is hardly a novel idea. It is used in most advanced democracies around the world. But we have had multi-member districts at various times in our history, although they weren't proportional. So the state legislature could pass a law for its own state election. So tomorrow, the Wisconsin state legislature could pass a law that state legislative elections for Wisconsin are elected through proportional multi-member districts. However, they cannot affect how the congressional delegation is elected, because Congress in 1967 passed a law requiring single-member districts, the Uniform Congressional Districting Act, which was passed to prevent southern states from moving to a system of block voting, which would have been very bad for minority representation. But ideally, Congress could pass a law that would either allow states to experiment with different forms of proportional representation by repealing the 67 prohibition on multi-member districts and allowing states to try out different approaches as long as they're proportional, or Congress could also mandate proportional multi-member districts. And there is, in fact, a bill, the Fair Representation Act, which is sponsored by Representative Don Beyer, which would do this. But I also want to point out that I was involved in a recent scholar's letter, over 200 esteemed scholars of democracy who agree that the single member district is well past its sell-by date. And in order to have fair representation in the U.S., we need to move to proportional multi-member districts.
We'll leave it there. Lee, thanks again for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rob. I hope the beginning of a real big conversation about how we do representation in the 21st century in America.
That's Lee Drotman, Senior Fellow in the Political Reform Program at New America, looking at his new report, What We Know About Redistricting and Redistricting Reform. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Wisconsin's bow hunting season is coming up. Get a preview, maybe join in with your questions or your experiences. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we talked about parking and the cost of free parking in some communities. As a follow-up, I have some thoughts on free parking on the Monopoly game board. You may know I'm a big fan of board games. Haven't played Monopoly in a while. There's a lot of other good games out there. But if I were to play, I would do one thing. If you're going to play Monopoly, here's my unsolicited advice. Don't do the thing where you get money when you land on the free parking spot. There's a good chance you learned to play the game, as I did, with money on free parking, with someone there to start, some of the fees and fines going on through the game. It's not in the rules, though. It's a house rule, and it's kind of a bad one. I know it's fun to win the free money, but the end game condition in Monopoly is people running out of money. Introduce a new revenue source. You add money into the game. It makes it last longer. It's not something Monopoly needs. By the way, I poked around online for some info. A 1991 computer game version let you set the free parking bonus anywhere from zero up to $65,000. It's a lot of money in Monopoly terms. The high cost of free parking. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll play some chess and listen to some hip hop with the founders of Milwaukee's Hip Hop Chess Club. Now, Vikings from around the Midwest will journey to Green Bay this weekend for the region's largest Viking festival. UW-Green Bay's Viking House will be the new permanent location for the annual festival that celebrates Scandinavian history and culture. Heidi Sherman is an associate professor of history and director of the Viking House at UW-Green Bay, which is hosting the Midwest Viking Festival this Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Heidi, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having us on.
And Tim Jorgensen is director of the Viking Connection for the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, Minnesota, one of the longtime coordinators of the Midwest Viking Festival. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tim, give us a taste. When someone comes to a Midwest Viking Festival, what are they going to see?
We try to give a comprehensive experience of all the different Viking crafts and activities that we can find artists to provide from around the world.
And what kind of activities?
Well, you know, the public's favorite seems to be the battle demonstration. So we'll certainly have that with talks about the different types of weapons and shields and how the armor functions as well. But we broaden out into blacksmithing, metalwork, and woodwork, the textiles, the cooking demonstrations, and even some more of the lesser common Viking Age arts and crafts. We always try to find somebody special to do that. So Thomas Riesholm's coming over. Well, he's here now already. Just got to Green Bay today from Denmark. He has a published book about beads of the Viking Age. So he'll be demonstrating glass bead making as a special international guest this year.
And Heidi, Vikings play a big role, I think, in popular culture. This is a deeper look, I think, than we might see on TV shows or comic books. So what are you hoping people take away in their understanding of the Vikings and Scandinavian culture more generally?
We're really trying to get away from the stereotype that all Vikings did was drink and fight and raid other people and each other. They did that, of course, but we're also interested in the tradition of handcraft in Scandinavia and Northern Europe, and having a Viking festival where people who study the Viking Age who are doing this crafts really attracts people, and it really emphasizes the possibilities of hands-on learning. And so we're really about daily life in medieval Scandinavia, but also where all the beautiful crafts that we see from Scandinavia, what their origins were, so if you go back 1,000 years in the Viking Age, you can see part of that process.
Tim, can you talk about the move from, I believe it was Fargo, North Dakota, to Green Bay, capturing the Viking Fest? What led to that move?
Yeah, we were held outside the Yumcomp Center in Moorhead, Minnesota for many years, and we're under the name Viking Village for so long. And we went through quite a bit in over a decade's time from being an independent Viking festival, just focusing on Vikings, to pairing up with the longer running Yumcomp Scandinavian Festival. And then when around the pandemic hit, we had some group discussions on what direction the County Historical Society wanted to take things. And it sounds like they agreed to focus more on the county's recent history, maybe in the last 100 or 200 years, as opposed to the last 1,000 years. I mean, of course, Vikings that we're dealing with for this event are a much older part of this, of the history of the people of this region, than those that were necessarily in Clay County, Minnesota. So the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, Minnesota is going to be doing a lot more with its more current cultural events and history. It's often just called the Viking Museum there, and that's kind of understandable because of the Yumcomp ship and the Halberstadt Stav Church, these two gigantic replica artifacts. But it's really the county's broader history needs to be in focus as well. So that's a change in a direction. But from my perspective as director of Viking Connection, one of our goals is to reach areas in the 5.5 state region that we work with where maybe Viking arts and crafts haven't had a presence, yet there's that underlying culture from the Scandinavian Americans that live in those regions. And Wisconsin is one of the states in the region we work with, and we haven't done much with Green Bay before. So here we are, and I love the grounds. The Viking house is the amount of space we have to work with, and the trees and everything is almost an exact copy of what we were working with at the Yumcomp Center. So I think it's a perfect home.
And Heidi, I wanted to ask you about the Viking house for people who haven't checked it out. Tell us more about it, please.
Yeah, the house was actually built by a couple in central Wisconsin, and they wanted to, I mean, they'd been studying the Viking Age since the early 70s, and I used to take students out there for experiential learning weekends, and then when they moved, they donated the house, and we raised the money to take the house apart and then rebuild it at the UW-Green Bay campus. Our campus is really experimental in a lot of ways and very much focused on experiential learning. So it was a great fit for us And so we've been able to hold lots of events, and we, you know, fundraise and get external monies to hold these events. And so now we're so excited. So people can come and see this Viking house, which is actually based on, it's called a Grin building, which is very familiar to Norwegian immigrants, because it was a type of structure. It's a, that was used, you know, on farms and as a boat shed, but also 1,000 years ago in the Viking age, it was also used as kind of like a townhouse. But so we are really excited to have one on public land, and anybody can is free to come and look at it. And of course, it's going to be open with the people who built the house showing it off at the Viking house on Friday and Saturday.
I want to ask,
welcome to come for a tour.
I want to ask each of you briefly, what craft or demonstration are you most excited about seeing this weekend? Let's throw that to you, Tim, first.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we put a lot into getting Thomas Friis home here from Denmark to demonstrate the glass bead making. And I think that'll certainly be a hit. He's going to be right near me and my woodcraft demonstration and display. I'll be making some toy swords out of wood, and those will be for kids. Anyone who wants one, stop by and I'll make sure you learn something along the way. But I should say we have a couple new faces. One of them I should mention is David Susek, who's going to be turning wood on a spring pole lathe. So wood bowls were a super common part of Viking Age daily life, and to see the process of how they were made is quite exciting using non-electric tools. So the spring pole lathe is a rope attached to a big springy pole operated by your foot, and it's just a fantastic thing to watch. So.
And Heidi, leave us with one thing you're particularly looking forward to.
I'm excited to have everybody come to the festival grounds. I want to say that the festival is sponsored by Wisconsin Humanities and also Viking Connection. We're very, very grateful that we're able to offer the experience free. So anybody is welcome to come. Just come have a good time. And there's absolutely no cost for this festival.
Thanks to both of our guests, Heidi Sherman, Associate Professor of History, Director of the Viking House at UW-Green Bay, and Tim Jorgensen, Director of the Viking Connection for the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, Minnesota, organizers of the Midwest Viking Festival in Green Bay this Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Find a link to event info at wpr.org/centraltime. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about Wisconsin's roadside attractions.
Author Eric Dragne has been a keen observer of roadside attractions for years. He recently wrote the book, The Impossible Road Trip, that chronicles the most famous stops across the U.S. And believe it or not, Wisconsin is home to some of the quirkiest. Dragne takes us on a tour of the best roadside attractions across the state.
I was born in the shadow of the world's largest six-pack in La Crosse. My mom told me later that the nurses in the hospital there even gave her a beer to help bring the milk. Despite this, I realized I'd never conquer the world's largest six-pack, since those six silos hold enough beer to provide one person a six-pack a day for 3,351 years. Being born in Wisconsin, I just assumed these gigantic sculptures of everyday objects were destined to take their rightful place along the roadside to lure in visitors. Then I lived in Italy with all the supposedly tasteful statues and architecture. Later, when Italian friends came to visit me in the Midwest, I tried to show off our impressive architecture, the old churches, the Capitol. They'd respond, "You know, these are all just imitations of Italian buildings. You have seen St. Peter's in Rome, no?" With this in mind, I resolved to show my own kids what is truly American. We set out on the Wisconsin byways. We saw talking cows, rusty dinosaur statues, and too many mice eating cheese to count. A giant bucky badger in Burnham Wood is now half buried next to signs promising hot girls, cold beer. We got lost in the labyrinth of House on the Rock near Spring Green and discovered Dr. Evermore near Baraboo, who gave us a tour of his Forevertron, a Jules Verne-esque steampunk rocket ship before he blasted off into the heavens. A trip into the kitsch world of Wisconsin Dells never disappoints. Except when we discovered that Tommy Bartlett's robot world was brought into the 21st century with no more cheesy 1970s evil robot slaves. And Xanadu, the foam house of tomorrow, has been unceremoniously discarded. Perhaps all that hardened foam from Xanadu was repurposed as the new giant Roman Colosseum next to the upside-down White House. Why just look at some ancient Greek statues and sterile museums when you can drive a go-kart through the belly of a six-story-tall Trojan horse? The best of Wisconsin's roadside attractions come from a burning desire by an obsessed individual to create giant monuments to prove that I was here, like Fred Smith's Concrete Park in Phillips. Even better are those that are the result of a practical joke, such as Rhinelander's Hodag, an elaborate hoax based on the capture of a mythical monster with photos that ran on the front page of newspapers across the country. This is not normal behavior, thank God. And Wisconsin is full of it. Midwestern tourist bureaus drool over the idea of a lucrative roadside attraction, but the best sites are seldom devised by a committee in a boardroom. The creators are artistic visionaries, scorned as kooks and crazies, but are the very ones who give our towns character. Why raise statues to some self-important governor when you can create your own idol, like the 143-foot-long muskie in Hayward? Wouldn't you rather see that than some dusty old Roman statue that's missing its arms? Many of these fiberglass artifacts were born in Sparta at the Fast Company. They made Hayward's muskie, and also a 55-foot half-man, half-peapod Jolly Green Giant in Minnesota, and a 38-foot-tall Holstein in North Dakota that is visible for 5 miles. My family and I visited their graveyard of discarded statues and seriously considered buying an enormous big boy for our front yard. What would the neighbors say? Instead, we put our ambitions aside, realizing we could never compete with the original grandeur of La Crosse's monument to beer.
Eric Dragne is the author of the new book, The Impossible Road Trip, about America's most famous roadside attractions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll check out Your Move Milwaukee, bringing young people together with hip-hop music and games of chess. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. A club in Milwaukee combines two things you might not always put together in your mind, hip-hop and chess. Every week, members of the Hip Hop Chess Club meet to play the ancient game, listen to rap, and learn, in some cases, how to break dance or freestyle themselves. Raquel Aleman is the co-founder and executive director of Your Move Milwaukee, or Your Move MKE. Brandon Kitts is co-founder, project director, and music coordinator for Your Move MKE. Raquel and Brandon, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us. This is amazing.
Raquel, could you tell us the origin and the idea of this hip-hop chess club?
Sure. The idea originated with us all just having a really good, solid friendship and creating this club to work with young people, help them think ahead and make better moves in their future. And we love hip-hop, so of course, incorporating that, production, freestyle, breakdancing, and all of the arts of hip hop. And it's grown into a pretty cool nonprofit. We've created a nonprofit out of it, and it's continues to grow into different programs as well.
Brandon, paint us a picture. A young person comes into a hip hop chess club, I think on a Tuesday night. What do they see? What do they do?
Yeah, it's not something that fully can be expressed through words, but I will do my best. You walk into Miss Yesenia's creative studio space on the south side of Milwaukee. And you can learn how to play chess. And also while listening to hip hop beats, we have microphones set up. We have beat machines set up where you can beatbox, freestyle, sing, learn how to make beats. We try to offer all the elements of hip hop so kids can learn how to express themselves better. And it's a really chaotic, but like really creative and just amazing atmosphere. It's something that you definitely have to go to experience though, for sure.
Raquel, let's focus on the chess side of things for a minute. What does a young person, I guess, what do any of us get out of focusing in on chess? What kind of lessons can we take out of it?
So the game of chess is really I guess it's a dope game because it helps you to really look at every angle, look at the whole board, as well as thinking before you make your moves, backing up your pieces. So we like to correlate that with everyday life for the young people. So, you know, while we're across the table from them, we're basically at the same level as them. It kind of puts us in the same eye level, so they feel like they can relate to us. And we're able to organically mentor them and talk with them about their life situation and correlate that with chess.
Now, Brandon, you are a rapper yourself. I understand you've written a little something for us about the project. You want to share it with us?
Oh, yeah, sure, definitely. I wrote this today, so I was super inspired by this, just the idea of doing this interview with you guys. So here it is. Yo, hip-hop chess club been around for half a decade. The object of the chess game? It's checkmate, but long-term is thinking on a higher level. Cognition and strategy to make the mind work better. Play with different people, develop my own style, be part of community with friendships as profound. We're all kings and queens, it's definitely known now, with more than enough positive energy to go around. Analytical to creative skills we came to build from the everyday stresses of staying in the mill, paying the bills. Ain't a game, this is real life. I feel like my tools are the bishops, rooks, and the knights at school. Not much more to it, this is your move, MKE. I implore you to explore new ways of being free. Believe you me, we could achieve whatever with chess, hip-hop, and we together forever.
All right, we're talking to Brandon Kitts and Raquel Aleman from Your Move MKE, talking about the hip-hop chess club there. In lyrical form there, we heard it from Brandon. Raquel, what has been the response so far? What are you hearing from young people in the area who get involved in this?
So the young people that come most often and are our regular kind of members or attendees, it's kind of hard to explain because we're more of a community. It's not really like a membership. Like, you don't fill out an application and come. We're really a community where it's more like a family. So the ones that have come and built a good relationship with us and the program, we hear from their parents that it helps them with their social skills. So we have some children that are homeschooled that don't really get to, you know, work with other children. Even with COVID being around and the kids being secluded, it really helped them get involved with other children and other people in the community. And it also helps with like intergenerational programming. So being able to have those adults and children mingling together and having the young people play with the adults and learn skills and even the young people beating the adults most regularly. So it's just a really awesome time with the kids. And we hear that they absolutely love it. And it's just a safe space for them in an area that they don't have many safe spaces.
And Brandon, you're doing this in Milwaukee. Now, people around the state are listening. If somebody's thinking, yeah, we should have something like this, I want our own hip hop chess club, what would you suggest to them on getting something like this started?
Well, originally we got started, the first hip hop chess club was created in Rhode Island by this our mentor, Crook Rock, Eric Mercado. And he actually got us off the ground running with the hip hop chess club. And we're more than willing to help anyone get off the ground with stuff like this. Like, just because we need each other, man. We really do need each other to build off and, you know, spread knowledge and stuff. So you can hit any of us up. You can check our Facebook page, or you can even go to our website, which is yourmovemke.org. You can contact us through that way. But yeah, I would definitely recommend, yeah, this should be in every city in America, if not the world. It's definitely a really cool idea, really awesome. It's a rewarding to be a part of too, you know. It's amazing.
And Raquel, I was so wondering, what is the next move for Your Move MKE? What are your hopes for the future of this project?
Sure. So as Brandon said, we started off as a club and a program, Hip Hop Chess Club. And since February 2020, we created Your Move MKE, which is actually a nonprofit. So we do have other programs as well. We have a youth-based open mic. We're hoping to open an urban trade skills program soon to help young people transition into trade skills and the union. And then we also do breakdancing to help with physical and emotional health. So everything that we do correlates basically higher level thinking and mental health or trauma healing. And we correlate it with hip hop. And our goal is to have a building and be able to offer all types of programming and creating different ways to bring that forward. So financial literacy, but a creative way to teach our kids. The old ways aren't working, so we need to do something new.
Now, Brandon, at a certain age, I might think, well, I'm not good at chess and I'm not good at rap. Well, that's still true. I'm not good at rapping. make a case that a kid with that lack of skills should still come in and check it out?
Because whatever you do, you know, you got to get your reps in. You got to, everyone starts at level one. Everyone begins at the beginning. I was terrible at chess. I was terrible at rapping. Now I'm okay at chess and I'm pretty good at rapping. So you just got to do it. You just got to go for it. And you're part of a community now, positive energy. And yeah, we build each other up. That's really what it is.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Raquel Aleman, co-founder and executive director of Your Move MKE, and Brandon Kitts, also co-founder, project director, and music coordinator for Your Move MKE. They talked to us about the Hip Hop Chess Club. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it can be challenging to find the right housing as we age or as our family members get older, and a housing shortage is making it more difficult in many communities. We'll check out some possible solutions, and you can share your stories. And some states around the country are ending or changing their cash bail systems for people accused of crimes. What happens next? We'll check out the latest research and find out what cash bail is supposed to accomplish in the first place. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.